Welcome to the BMJ's podcast on decolonizing health and medicine. I'm Jocelyn Clark, the journal's international editor, and I've come to the BMJ with a real passion and commitment to decolonial and equitable practices in publishing and editing. This podcast is part of a larger project at the BMJ to contribute to debates and progress towards decolonizing institutions and knowledge systems in health and medicine. We've been listening to and learning from experts and colleagues around the world, and they tell us that present inequities and lack of progress in health are linked to a failure to confront colonial pasts. We invite you to listen to these conversations with these experts, and we welcome your feedback.
This is the fourth episode in our podcast series where we're trying to navigate through the complexities of decolonizing health. I'm Navjot Lada, clinical editor at the BMJ, and as this series unfolds, we hope to explore how ideas and structures first established in colonial times have permeated medicine, science, global health, and our everyday clinical practice. Throughout this series, the way in which colonization created structures of privilege that are self-perpetuating has become apparent, and the institutions of research are part of that. While the BMJ is one of those institutions, and we'll be turning the spotlight on ourselves in the next episode, this is about the larger network of institutions that fund, conduct, and disseminate research around the world. The panel with me on this episode have all carried out research and are now using that experience to try and improve the way in which it is conducted. So let's meet them. Perhaps I could start by asking you to introduce yourselves. Manira.
I'm a psychologist by training, and I got into global health research, as you may say, as a coincidence. It's not that I was particularly trained. I have been engaging with this discourse for about 2 years now. And what I feel is, I think, of course, how one views decolonization depends on your position, where you're based, where you're working, and how you see things, and for whom you think or who is the ultimate beneficiary of decolonization. For me, I think in the end of the day, it's the outcome or the goal for decolonization would be equities for our people, for our community. And a gap that I find in this discourse has been that the conversation still centers the global north. It still centers the power there. It still is about equitable partnerships between the north and the south. And somehow I feel our image as someone, or my image as someone in the south, is of a like helpless, powerless victim who's looking for saviors in the north. And this time it may not be white saviors, but maybe non-white saviors. And I kind of disagree with it.
Thank you so much. And hopefully we can dig deeper into some of those issues over the course of this episode. Angela, I'll come to you next. The same thing. So please do introduce yourself and let us know briefly, you know, how you take the call to decolonize global health and how it features in your work.
Thank you. So my name is Angela Obasi. I'm a researcher at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. And I come to this question of decolonization as a northern-based researcher who is part of the African diaspora. Both my parents are Nigerian. And as a researcher from the diaspora, I bring that to my work and to my sense of mission. For me, decolonization is ultimately about power. It is about the localization of power in terms of funding, in terms of who decides what research is important, who decides what research is good, who decides where research is done. But I've also been part of an initiative to try and address one of the most powerful and impactful inequities, which is that of authorship.
Yes, thank you so much, Angela. I hope we can dig into that for sure. And Sam, coming to you next, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you very much, Navjoy. So my name is Samuel Uti. I am a senior program specialist with Canada's International Development Research Centre. And just to be clear, I am not here speaking on behalf of IDRC. I am speaking in my own personal capacity as a public health researcher, as someone who's practiced medicine in Africa, as someone who identifies as a Black person who lives in the global South. Again, I don't like that term, but for lack of a better term, as someone who lives in the global South. I think what confuses or baffles me the most is that when we talk about global health, the essence often is about tackling inequalities in health and in healthcare. And so for me, it's a bit of a paradox that here is a field that is preaching equity and equality, and yet there's so many manifestations of inequality in its practice. So long story short, for me, decolonization is really about reclaiming our humanity as practitioners, as researchers, as experts in global health who are based in and live in the global South. It's about reasserting our self-determination and our agency. But it's not just about looking outwards. It's also about holding our own leaders accountable who, whether by commission or omission, are also being used as tools of, should I say, neocolonization, whether they like it or not.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And yes, it's so interesting, isn't it, how the decolonization movement itself seems to be perpetuating many of the problems it's trying to solve. But we'll park that for now. And Liam, come to you for you to introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Liam Smith. I'm a director at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I'm also a clinician, general practitioner. Long career as a clinical epidemiologist, working in partnership with different people and institutions in the UK and indeed around the world. And yeah, a long term interest in this whole area. Just a little bit like the others, I'll say that I'm sort of speaking in a personal capacity, we haven't got a kind of official institutional line here. So I'm just speaking in a personal capacity. And I really agree with what the past, the three panelists have all said, really. And so I'll try and say something in addition to all of that. The London School was set up really as a colonial institute. We have a very strong colonial past. Focused primarily on when we were established just over 125 years ago on essentially, it's written down, not in an official policy document, but in a description of the school as its main job being to sort of keep white people healthy in the tropics, which is pretty terrifying. Now, over the years, London School has done a lot of good work, but undoubtedly that colonial past has moulded the ways we've worked, and of course is imprinted and continues to be imprinted today. You don't get rid of a past like that easily. So while I think that unlearning colonial ways of doing things and ways of thinking is important, I don't really like the term decolonizing, I have to say, because I think it's actually about a positive way forward that's better, that matters more to me. I have to say, I also don't really like the term global health. and I fear that global health does two harmful things. One is that it suggests that there's this little bit of niche sort of health science that's global health, and then the rest of serious health and genomics and drug discovery and all these crucially important things are something else, and that global health is this little niche. And I don't think that's true at all. For me, whether it's the safety of diabetic drugs or finding new vaccines or getting decent treatments for and tests for cancer or whatever, these all matter to the people with the biggest health burdens. They matter more to the people with the biggest health burdens. So our focus as a community, world community, needs to be on those people with the most to gain from health research and from better education, wherever they are.
Thank you very much, Liam. We have been, in the course of this series, thinking about how colonialism and imperialism have influenced sort of the practice of medicine, health research, the way journals practice. And for this episode, as we've talked about, we want to really hone in and look at academic institutions, funding bodies, research, you know, people who do research, and talk about how colonialism plays out there. And I know that you are all very much, you know, steeped in efforts of decolonizing work, anti-colonial work. But for our listeners, I thought it would be useful to just have a quick sort of, I guess, explanation really of how do colonial era injustices specifically manifest in universities and research institutions and funding bodies? What are the impacts that people will see?
Liam talked about is partnerships. I think that's something that we all care very much about. You know, nobody can do global health without partnerships, but those partnerships have to be fair, and the way currently global health is funded, because of the way that funding flows from north to south in the vast majority of research collaborations, the power lies that the potential for those collaborations to be fair is destabilized. The reward mechanisms of academic institutions getting promoted, getting your publications, getting credit so that you can move up as an academic. All of those are weighted in such a way as to disadvantage they currently de-incentivize fairly recognizing the contributions of partners in the South. And until that changes, it is very difficult to see how we can achieve this more utopian view of really genuinely focusing with, you know, trust and respect on the health problems that are prioritized by people in those settings, as Munira has really passionately said, to achieve those goals. And what's needed is a radical transformation. So, you know, when you're going to your promotions panel, it isn't about how much money you have raised as a principal investigator. It's actually about how you have facilitated equitable partnership, how you have ensured the development, the advancement of your collaborators. That is not currently a metric that I'm aware of in any Northern research institute, or is certainly not the one that counts, you know, because we all, there is this, there's the written rules and the real rules. And at the end of the day, the real rules are still, you're going to get promoted if you get your authorship and you get your grants. And until that changes, until fairness and pro-equity activity is valorized above those other things, the system is not going to change.
Well, I would want to talk a little bit about how we go about doing that, but we've got Sam with his hand up and Liam. So Sam, I'll come to you first.
Thank you, Navjoy. I'm just jumping on what Angela said. I think one of the main manifestations in my experience, as someone who works for a funder, but who has also been a researcher and a public health or global health person, is the invisibilization of capacity in the global South. So more often than not, when I sit in different fora, whether it's a fora of funders or different stakeholders or, you know, different partners, and we are talking about an issue, a topic, a thematic, one comment that always recurs is that, well, there's still capacity in the global South for this or for that. And that has many issues. First of all, more often than not, there is capacity. It's just that not in the way, perhaps not in the way that is defined by the people who claim that there is no capacity. And sometimes even in the way they defined it, there is capacity, but if not bothered to look. And so sometimes we just use it as an excuse for us to intervene. That is an excuse for us to go and save these people who need to be saved because they don't have the capacity.
What do you see happening to address that? From your perspective, just before we come to you, Liam.
Yes, I think a number of things, and some funders are beginning to do that. I mean, do the hard work and find the capacity and who has the capacity, because if you really look, you'll find it. And where the capacity doesn't exist in one format or in one discipline, you can empower organizations that have shown or individuals that have showed potential in another discipline to cross over if necessary or to pivot if necessary. And I have personal experience doing that. So when IDRC, when we wanted to support research on non-communicable diseases in Africa, at the time when we started making investments in this space, a lot of the proposals we were getting from Africa were not that strong. And so rather than just throw the baby and the bathwater, so to say, we took the time to support organizations in the Global South to begin to build their capacities, to strengthen their capacity. So we call it field building, right? So, almost walking the walk with them, being patient, and then helping the field grow organically, right? Rather than having to parachute people in to do the work so that we can see quick wins and get quick results and then fly out and leave those geographies the same way we found them.
Thank you. Fascinating. Liam?
I was going to come back on a specific point Angela made, and it's about promotions or whatever, academic progressions at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And what's interesting is that both in our written guidance, and I can promise you in the spirit of it, because I've been there, very positively, we do not look at, how much grant income has this poor person brought to the school. It's all about what role have they played in projects, in obtaining with partners funding that's appropriately flowed. What have they led on? What have they contributed to? And how have they contributed more globally to things? And on authorship, which is quite interesting, is I've fairly pretty recently been in quite a few committees where the fact that somebody's been doing quite a lot of work, often in a low income setting, and is recurrently the kind of first or senior author on publications that have, where clearly most of the work has been done and most likely co-led at the very best, or possibly led altogether by people from the lower income setting. That's really looked on as quite a pretty, with a big frown, as really quite disrespectful, and in fact worse than that. So this idea that people have to have first, or should be last, or whatever, I can tell you for certain that we are implementing the opposite of that. What's interesting is that even within the institution, and it shows how strongly embedded the traditional views are, even in the institution, people don't believe that.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think at the sort of journal end of that culture is so pervasive and similar to what we've just been talking about when it comes to sort of colonial mindsets. I think there is a process of unlearning that needs to happen there as well. Andrew, I think you just want to respond to a point quickly, and then I'll come to Manira.
Yes. Thank you so much. I do want to respond to that. So that is really wonderful to hear, Liam. And this is part of, I've got a piece of work together with Shea Bimbola, Ben Morton, a number of us have been working really hard on this, and we've been working with other journals to try and promote this discussion about equitable authorship and making sure that the authorship representation really does de-invisibilize as Sam has said, the contributions of local authors. And if there is sanctions for disrespecting that, if the culture changes so that those people who overclaim are being challenged, then that is a very good thing. But it's not yet as widespread as we would like. And one of the things that I think it would be really good to unpack is how that, how this sharing of credit and including financial resourcing, making sure that funding flows properly to the South, can be unpacked. Because one of the challenges that I've had, and again, I'm not speaking on behalf of LSTM, I'm speaking as a researcher who is also a clinician who has been in partnerships with excellent researchers based in several countries in Africa. One of the challenges that we have had is that the on costs that that putting money through the Northern Institution place on a grant are so enormous. And so it then becomes very difficult to ensure that the funding adequately reaches the local partners, and I'd be very interested to hear as the discussion goes on how that deinvesting or promoting investment elsewhere is going to be sustained as a funding model for these small universities or businesses. Sure.
That is a critical part of the conversation, isn't it? The seeding, CEDE of power and resources, I think, that and sort of redressing that imbalance. Munira, I'd love to bring you in and for your perspective on this as well.
Thank you very much. And I agree with what everybody's saying. And I would like to add that what happens or the culture that is in the North seems to replicate or we imitate such behaviors in the South as well, and at every level. And I think at this point, we also need to, or I realize there's a role of our institutions in the South. Whatever money that comes in or how our funding flows, that still is not equitably used. For example, when you talk about capacity strengthening, if I talk about my country, there's just one or two people that are present in every conference everywhere worldwide. So why haven't they really promoted in their 70s, in the 60s? Not a single person who they can send or who they can promote as their mentor or someone who can lead after they have left. Why does, I mean, and that again is part of the problem of funding. You know, I think academia is very risk averse. We like to invest, we like to fund few individuals who can then become very strong, at some point even stronger than institutions, I think. And it's not that we don't have the power to negotiate authorship, it's just we don't do it. Our institutional leadership is not interested.
And I think you've written about this in Lancet Global Health, I believe, the navigating the violent process of decolonization in global health research. And I think what you was sort of articulating in that article is that there is a responsibility for people in those institutions in kind of, I think what you referred to as kind of the colonized country, you know, the colonized need to take that responsibility as well.
Yeah.
Well, I'm conscious of time, and we have touched on some of the things that are happening and the kind of, the steps to a sort of more equitable or anti-colonial future in academic institutions. I'd love to find out a bit more about perhaps the work that's going on where you are, or what you think needs to happen next as well, and any, you know, examples of best practice. Perhaps we could just go around and you could talk to us about, you know, where you see things heading, you know, and what your kind of outlook is, if you like. Sam, maybe I'll come to you first. We haven't heard from you for a while.
Thank you. So I think we've sort of all alluded to an important point that funders are probably the primary culprits in perpetuating some of the power imbalances that we find in global health. Maybe we've not said it explicitly, but I get that sense. And we have such an outsized role in determining the whether partnerships are equitable, for example, whether capacities are recognized and strengthened in the right way. And so I would turn my attention to funders and what they can do to improve the way, or to do things better, so to say. And I think it's time for funders to revisit the idea of organizational strengthening in the Global South. Because what it does, when you focus on strengthening organizations rather than, as Munira said, strengthening individuals to the extent that they even become more powerful than institutions, is that you create a legacy that on even an ecosystem that now enables people, researchers, academics within that institution to assert their agency and to thrive. So why don't we think of some kind of tenure track for organizations? Because organizations in the Global South, I guess as elsewhere, they fall in a spectrum. They are not homogeneous, right? So we have young institutions, we have institutions that have 20, 30, 40, 50 years of expertise, right? Can we create an incentive, sort of a tenure funding tenure track system, or organizational strengthening tenure track system that moves institutions in the Global South and incentivizes them to move along this track, to get to a point where, you know, they become really strong and established institutions, and doesn't just focus on projects, doesn't focus on programs, doesn't focus on individuals. And I think when you do that, you begin to see some of these institutions rise to a point where, you know, they can stand toe to toe with their counterparts in the Global North. And then we can really begin to see the benefits of and the possibilities of equitable partnerships.
Really interesting. Thank you, Sam. Munira, did you want to respond to what Sam was saying?
I would just like to quickly add, I completely agree with what he has said. It's a great idea, you know, development of an entire ecosystem. The only thing I would like to add is it has to be a certain criteria for which organizations or institutions are being selected. We don't want the usual suspects, again, to be the ones who are being funded and who become the only institutions within that country who then are who hold all that power.
Right. Munira, while we're with you, do you want to just tell us a little bit about your outlook on next steps and what needs to happen now?
You know what I was thinking? I think, just like Liam was saying, there are good things happening in this institution. Maybe we need to have more stories about what's good happening as well, you know, like positive deviants. How are people still managing to be equitable in their partnerships? How are they still able to fund or to spend their funding in an equitable manner? So, and I think there's a room now. Maybe there is good work going on. We are not able to hear it, but maybe recognizing those individuals, those teams, those organizations who are trying to do things differently in a way that we all may want to emulate.
Yeah, sort of sharing best practice. Yeah. Great, thank you. And Liam, how about you? Where do you see the direction for the school and your leadership of it?
another hour, no. I'll tell you what, I'll take a cue from Munira and I'll try and come out with some positives, because I think that's really important. I think it's about looking at good things that can happen. So we've started a big process and have made some progress on what's called sort of decolonizing the curriculum in terms of learning and teaching. And what's interesting to me is that this is clearly going to be a long-term ongoing process. This is about changing the whole approach and content of what we teach long-term. It's not like a one-off step. And my worry that decolonizing the curriculum sounds like it's something you do and it's ticked. So this is about the kind of, whether it's the examples being used or the whole kind of approach being taught. So that's one thing that I think, yeah, and we've made really positive progress and actually had quite a surprisingly positive engagement from a lot of staff on that, which has been really great. Another positive example, just to give, I agree with Sam that funders are really key. And I think some of the big funders, certainly in the UK, are thinking hard about this and taking some steps. And I would just give some credit to Wellcome. Some years ago, I was involved in a big partnership with Brazilian researchers. And very much along the lines of the money following where the work was going to happen and where the work needed to happen and where the resources were needed. The vast majority of the money went to Brazil, which was exactly the right thing to happen. And Wellcome were very open to that idea, and the money went directly to Brazil, and you know, and whatever was needed in London came to London. And it was quite an early example of a funder sort of stepping up and doing, you know, changing how they view things. So I think there are positive examples. I can also give you another positive. I'm just involved in trying to recruit a new director of a medical research council unit in Uganda, and I can tell you we've got a fantastic field of African scientists, both sort of mid and more senior, and it's really fantastic to get and to see exactly as Sam says, that capacity is there, that expertise is there, and we to build on and to extend, you know, and to help further sort of grow. But it's but it is there, and it's just a positive thing to end on, I guess.
Yeah, thank you. And Angela, then coming to you, last but not least, by any means, where do you see these efforts going, and how heartened or not do you feel?
So, thank you. I think it's as Munira and Liam have said, it's really good to think about the positives, what's already happening. So, for example, NIHR has opened their global professorships to everybody, whereas previously these were these very prestigious and very powerful awards that funded an individual and an entire team. These were only accessible to UK researchers, and now researchers from throughout all over the world can get them. Other kinds of positive action that with the NIHR, for example, this is not just on decolonization, but for example, if you're going to put forward two professors, one of them has to be a woman. There's those kinds of there's those kind of initiatives that funders can take. And as Sam says, funders have a really powerful role. You know, they have their hands on the most powerful levers for change within the global health ecosystem. But I also think we need to be honest with ourselves. These are institutions that are made up of individuals who have their own agendas and who have an incentive to maintain the power that they have, and that's part of that goes to the heart of the problem, really, within decolonization. Is that colonialism is about power. There was a group of people who had power and resources, and they use that power and resources to subjugate another group of people. And whilst I think it's, you know, looking forward is very is important, and it's a helpful outlook, I think there is real danger in forgetting that these systems of power flow and power alignment are still here and are still live and are still active. The revolution has to be a smart revolution. It can't just be a tick box exercise. Otherwise, what then happens is the people who have been subjugated continue to be subjugated because the systems of power have not been broken. This needs to be transformative. And the central question is about how institutions like LSTM and LSHTM cede their power.
The role of journals came up quite a bit in that discussion. And of course, journals are another set of institutions in the research ecosystem, another set of institutions that have to cede their power in this space if we are really to decolonize. We wanted to talk about what journals as a system can do. And as we have a full episode on the BMJ specifically, we wanted to explore what systemically needs to happen to change these power dynamics. To discuss that, we have two editors who have been very involved in this work, Shay Abimbola, who you've already heard from, and Jocelyn Clark. Shay, can I get you to introduce yourself first?
Thank you very much, Navjot. I am Shay Abimbola. I am a Nigerian trained medical doctor. And so I've had quite an exposure to medicine from quite a while ago, began as a medical student. And also, interestingly, my exposure to medical journals began as a medical student. I was editor-in-chief of my medical school's medical student-run academic journal, while at the same time I was writing for the student BMJ. So I've been related to the BMJ for quite a long time.
Yeah. I should point out, because I didn't introduce you in this way, but you are the editor-in-chief of BMJ Global Health. And great. Okay. Well, Jocelyn, coming to you now.
Thanks, Navjot. It's great to be included in this conversation. I'm Jocelyn Clark, the international editor of the BMJ, and most recently was executive editor of The Lancet, and previous to that, senior editor at PLOS Medicine and executive editor at the Journal of Health, Population and Nutrition.
Shay, coming back to you, you know, as a scholar in this space, you're an editor of a global health journal. What do you see as the role of journals and publishers in contributing to decolonizing health and medicine? And, you know, we know that journals play an important role in the construction of knowledge. So what do you think they can do to help shift or seed the power that advocates of this sort of decolonization movement call for?
That's a very big question.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and... and answer it in a very unstructured way. I think perhaps the first thing to say, because we are talking here from a BMJ platform, is to first acknowledge that there's no BMJ without colonization. And I think that's an important thing to acknowledge for the BMJ and for other journals like it. That there is, we sit on a certain privilege, and we must put that privilege to good use. One of the central tenets of colonization was the delegitimization of other people's knowledges or other people as knowers, and the destruction of other people's knowledge systems. Now, for me, one of the things that a journal like the BMJ or journals can do is to target that as a focus of reversal. How do we reverse what had happened? Because I believe decolonization is giving back or has a restorative, reparative function. Is what does it look like to first recognize things, legitimize things that have been delegitimized, recognize people whose dignity as knowers have been violated by the colonial experience and mission, begin to have conversations and take action on what it looks like to reconstitute knowledge system epistemic communities that were disrupted and destroyed because of colonization. Now, I know those are really big things to think about, but they're also things that journals have the power to do. So it's not as though it's one of those things you say, oh, someone should do it. You should actually do this if you wanted to do it. And a good example of that, to my mind, is the kind of methods, for example, but the kinds of knowledges that a journal publishes. There was an interesting outcry a few years ago when the BMJ said they were not publishing qualitative research. The Lancet doesn't publish qualitative research. Neither does almost any big journal. And it says something that they don't. It says something about how we've decided to imagine what the world looks like, how we've decided to imagine what evidence looks like. And how we've chosen to simplify things that are complex, how we've chosen to do yes or no, black or white, thin out knowledge. How we've chosen, for example, that the kind of knowledge, for example, that qualitative research surfaces, tend to be the kinds of knowledge that disrupt power, tend to be the kind of knowledge that come from a place of struggle and contestation. And the kind of knowledge that the very finely tuned quantitative research that we tend to publish tend to focus are things that are very micro, very downstream, things that do not threaten power, things that do not ask questions that are structural or upstream. So it is not by accident that we find ourselves in a place where we've chosen that certain kinds of knowledge we would never touch and certain kinds of knowledge we would embrace and legitimize. So for me, one of the things to do is to re-examine that decision and ask ourselves, why do we do that? The second one for me is to ask what role a journal or a publisher like the BMJ has in the fact that a Zambia, a Ghana, a Nigeria does not have its own BMJ. I often make this analogy that the BBC cannot do for Nigeria what it does for Britain. It's not possible. And the BMJ cannot do for Nigeria what it does for Britain.
There's so much more we could dive into, but Jocelyn, I want to come back to you. And, you know, you've been involved in diversifying and globalizing the medical literature, and in particular, advocating for more representation of women and colleagues in low and middle income countries. Over the course of your career, have you seen demands and actions shift or change around these issues? And can you tell me what practical steps, you know, that we could use to respond? You know, what policies, guidance or strategies can journals and editors take to advance decolonial or anti-colonial approaches?
For journal editors, decolonialism can be an education about how the past is not the past. Colonial histories have profound impacts on present healthcare inequities and health outcomes. So if you're a journal editor interested in global health or health equity, you can't not be concerned with what decolonialism can teach you about your role in generating knowledge for health that's more equitable, more inclusive, more just. For me, the education has been really impactful. So I see decolonialism as a mindset, a kind of approach to the work. And just like feminist theories in health, this for me has been a really powerful lens to encourage self-reflexivity on power and privilege. I think this is a powerful lens for us as editors to be more critical of our own practices and be more understanding of our role and responsibility as a main player within a knowledge production system that is profoundly exploitative and inequitable. So some of the steps we can take are to continue to work hard to ensure equity, diversity, and inclusion. Some of these steps are very practical, but I feel like they're necessary. We need to be doing more to diversify our authors and reviewers, especially the commissioned content, which we have a lot of control over, making use of the much broader pool of available expertise from around the world. We're trying to do this at the BMJ with our Regional Advisory Board program, which draws upon the expertise of international health experts to help guide our content strategies and ensure our international health content is aligned with regional health priorities. Journal editors can also ensure that global health content, for example, is authored and peer-reviewed by individuals who have the requisite expertise and lived experience. And I think we can be broadening the areas of content that we're publishing on. The Decolonizing Health podcast and article collection is one example of how we're at the BMJ trying to contribute to contemporary conversations and debates in health, but probably all journals could do better to surface those critical social science and other multidisciplinary perspectives on health and medicine that are available. And again, while these are practical steps, they might be considered, you know, low-hanging fruits, at the same time, they're necessary, and I do think they will go some way to supporting epistemic justice, as we've been discussing. I really want us as journals to be more accountable to our stated values of equity and our commitments to equity, diversity, and inclusion. Because even the big journals, the really big high-profile journals like the BMJ and the Lancet, which have global health missions, are increasingly wanting to publish in the international health spaces and be influential. Still, in many of the journal pages, these are dominated by high-income country men. So we have a lot more work to do. What decolonialism tells us is that this is about shifting and ceding power. So that means all of us as editors, but in particular high-profile journals, have to recognize our own role in perpetuating inequities if we continue with business as usual. Shifting power includes centering the perspectives and interests of those who have been unrepresented in the literature thus far, and indeed those who have been marginalized by colonialism.
There's so much more we could go into, but I think we're rapidly running out of time. So I'll just come to you both and ask you, you know, any sort of for your concluding thoughts, final thoughts, pressing next steps. Tell us what you think, Shay.
There's, I think, something to be mindful of about cosmetic change. Mm. There's a sense in which they are inevitable. Or perhaps, at best, one might wish to see them as the first steps in towards a bigger change. Mm. But they are very often steps taken to avoid a bigger change. Yeah. I've observed that in many entities, including journals, and I would name journals now, but there are journals who believe that they've decolonized now, or at least they should not be spoken to as people who need to do anything, because we now have black and brown people all over the place. Guys, you know, we're it. So there is that problem worth thinking about the future. Another problem is that in many ways, as journal editors, we receive what gets submitted to us. We have a bit of influence on what people might submit, but very, very little in many cases. And very often, you know, the journal that I edit, we would publish things that I know shouldn't be published, right? But they are good by the standards of today, right? Mm. By how we do science today, they are great, right? But they are not great. Yeah. Through a decolonial lens, they're not great.
Right.
But we publish them. In part because, well, the journal is a business, but also because the truth of the matter is that that is what the world looks like today. And for me, there's this constant tension. Should I explain to a person who has done this brilliant piece of work funded by this big grant that this is not great? Or should I just say, okay, accept or reject without explanation? Because to explain is to trigger a very, very long conversation that will not end. So these are, for me personally, as a journal editor, making decisions about research, especially, there are things that bother me, but I also know I don't have solutions to necessarily. Yeah. Sorry, just one more point to emphasize something Jocelyn said earlier about the very extractive nature of the journal business. It's worth mentioning as well that some of our perception of what is a predatory journal have been created by journals and publishers that want to maintain their hold on the industry. It's an expression I don't use generally because I understand what lies underneath it. Mm. And one of them is that local journals in local spaces serving local needs, if there are too many of them, they will start to eat into what the big journals have always fed fat on, right? Plus, those journals will not need to exist if the big journals were truly global, right? If they were truly global, then those gaps will not exist within the ecosystem that require that some people fill them with something. So again, just thinking about the extractiveness of things and the labeling of things and what that means for the future. One more point before I close, which is closely related, I think, to the point about what gets submitted. That there is often an assumption, goes back to your point about evidence hierarchy. There's often an assumption about what is great knowledge. And what is great knowledge tends to be what people assume is universal. That if I say A is true, then it's true everywhere, right? And often people will sort of expect that kind of knowledge to be placed top of the hierarchy. Or if you read a systematic review on, say, tools for measuring something, and once authors or scholars find that there are different tools in different places, it is automatically a bad thing, right? That the world is not using one thing. That the world is not one thing. There's not a single version of everything. There's not a single measure of child growth, for example. Or there's no single measure of how healthcare workers perform in relation to their community. And it's so deep. It's so deep in how we think of research that it comes out without, just comes out. That's what people write. Mm. And I know that's deeply, deeply, deeply colonial, universalizing way of thinking about the world. But again, is it my job as an editor to correct that? Or is it the job of their teachers in their graduate degree to correct that? Going back again to what Justin said about education, just there's a long way to go, and we're only just beginning.
Yeah, so many things there that we could dig deeper into, but lots of food for thought. Thank you, Shay. And Jocelyn, any kind of final thoughts from you?
Just to summarize, while we're, you know, we should remain committed to being part of progressive change. Mm-hmm. Any one of us within this broader system has, I mean, there's levels of responsibility, but we all have a role to play. And I want this conversation to continue to be really enriching, challenging for people, but also really, really inclusive. But we're going forward. We're not going back, as far as I'm concerned.
Should I give you a sound bite, just in case you want a sound bite? I have a sound bite.
Okay.
Which is in reaction to something that Jocelyn said earlier, which is that there are other disciplines and fields that have been talking about the issues of decolonization for a very long time. And in many ways, us in medicine and health are very new to it. And our newness reminds me of how I felt when economists discovered randomized controlled trials. They went to town. It was the biggest toy in town. Everyone was celebrating. They even got a Nobel Prize for it. And I know health and medicine people couldn't stop rolling their eyes. And I often feel that this is how social scientists and historians must feel about us in health and medicine, that these guys have just discovered this thing and they're very happy about it. But we've been at this for a very long time. It just reminds me that is very likely the same feeling in those other fields, the same way I felt about economists going on and on about RCTs.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Lots of people roll their eyes at us.
Many thanks to our guests for joining us for this really interesting discussion. If you've enjoyed it as well and you want to hear more, do check out the other episodes in the series, where we'll be exploring the impact of colonialism on health and medicine, why we need to reckon with our past in order to move forward, the intersection of colonialism with feminism, and what we, as an institution, should be doing with all the information we've learned. These episodes and a series of articles and viewpoints on this work are all available for free online. You can check them out at www.bmj.com/decolonizing-health, and you can find that link in the show notes as well. If you'd like to add to the discussion, we would really love to hear from you, and you can get in touch by leaving a rapid response to one of the articles. We hope you found this episode interesting and enlightening, and that you are able to join us in this journey of figuring out what decolonization means for us individually. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.